It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about the study of animal intelligence. Later in the hour, I'll talk with primatologist Jill Preetz about her observations of chimpanzees in Senegal. But with me right now is one of the world's best-known primatologists and biologists. He was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. He is a professor at Emory University and the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta, Georgia. In his new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? He sets out to answer that question. He also asks many other questions that scientists may be able to answer in the future. And he is with me now. Franz de Waal, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be there.
I think right now in 2016, it's really easy for us to take for granted so much of the work that you and your colleagues have done over the last 40 years, 50 years even. But when you first started studying chimpanzees and in writing about what you found, the world was not such a friendly place for someone who wanted to talk about animal intelligence. Tell me a little bit about the deep divide there was in the scientific community and that there still remains.
Yeah, you know, even the term animal cognition could not be used because animals had instincts and animals had simple learning, but cognition was too big a word for what animals did. And so people were extremely skeptical. In the previous century, animals were mostly tested in little Skinner boxes where they could do little else than pressing a lever and getting a reward. And that was done with pigeons and rats. So in addition, with small-brained species compared to, let's say, an elephant or a dolphin and so on. And so there was a very low opinion of what animals could do. And it's only in the last 25 years or so that we are dropping that view and that we are getting into the real meat of animal intelligence by much more creative types of testing. And what you see on the internet, probably every week you see now a news item about something smart that animals are doing. And that's all the result of a new generation of scientists who is exploring that.
Now, when you published your first book, Chimpanzee Politics, back in 1982, it was based on a six-year project where you had been observing the political behaviors of chimpanzees that were in a zoo. When you published that book, where you gave the label of Machiavellian intelligence to these chimpanzees, you were also taking an incredible risk as a young primatologist.
Yeah, actually, that book is very up to date now with all the stuff that's going on in this country. I think we're seeing everyday chimpanzee politics going on. But when I wrote that, yes, I was postulating that these chimpanzees had strategies and they were planning. And because the reason we speak of politics is that the power structure in a chimp society is not just decided by who is the strongest, but also who has the best friends. And if you get to the top position with the help of your friends, you need to do something for your friends, of course, to pay them back. And so it's a very complex, almost democratic system. And I was describing that. And at the time, we didn't have very strong, let's say, experimental evidence for planning in chimpanzees. Now we do. We actually have evidence for that, mostly done in sort of laboratory testing. But at the time, this was all based on observations, and it postulated feelings, and it postulated reconciliation between chimps after fights. And people were a bit skeptical about all these things in those days. But it's also the time where things started to change. That was in the 1980s. And I think we saw the first signs in that period of scientists getting more open-minded about animal intelligence than they had been before.
In studying primates and studying some of our closest relatives on Earth, you use so many examples of scientific experiments that really give us insight into how, for example, chimpanzees' minds, their brains work. But you also cite a lot of examples of experiments that were conducted that you felt did not give us any insight into how their brains work because scientists were approaching these tests with a very human-centric viewpoint. And one of the examples that you used was an experiment that was testing whether chimpanzees could recognize human faces. Can you tell me a little bit about that research and the idea that it kind of represents?
Yes. Human face recognition was considered at the time as a special capacity. We were excellent face recognizers, and other animals, unfortunately, did not have the capacity. And they had determined that by testing chimpanzees on computers where they showed human faces. And the first time I heard about that, I was sort of amazed. I said, why did you use human faces? Because it didn't seem logical to me. But the scientists said, well, if human faces are so different one from the other, if they cannot do those, then they certainly cannot do other faces. And that's a sort of the anthropocentric view. That's a very human-focused view where we think that our faces are so special that they are the easiest to recognize, whereas maybe for a capuchin monkey, the faces of capuchin monkeys are easier to recognize. And so we started testing our chimps on chimpanzee faces. So we set up a touch screen and we gave them faces and let them see if they could recognize them. And the chimps were just as good as humans are. Then some other people started testing monkeys. Chimps are not monkeys, by the way. Chimps are apes. And so some people started testing monkeys, and the monkeys were very good at it as well. Now we have even studies on sheep. There's a scientist in Great Britain who works with sheep, and to me, all sheep look alike, but to sheep, they don't look alike, and they can recognize those faces. And so now we feel, actually, that since also the same brain areas are involved in face recognition in monkeys and humans, that face recognition is a very general characteristic that we're probably going to find in many different species.
Well, and it's interesting that facial recognition of human faces has also been tested in other species now, including crows. And crows can recognize human faces, which doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense for them to even have that skill.
Yeah, I don't think that crows recognize each other by faces because they have so many other things to go by, like the flight pattern and the vocals. And I think crows are not paying attention to each other's faces necessarily. But human faces are, of course, the easiest way to recognize humans. And crows have very sharp eyes, and they use that skill to determine who's a good guy and who's a bad guy. And so actually the experiment that was done with crows, I think these were wild crows, were to capture them and to put a mask on. And so the capturer of the crows would have a certain mask, face mask on, and then the thing of the mask is that you can move it around, and so you can put it on other people. And each time someone with that mask on would walk over the college campus where they did these experiments, the crows would be yelling at them and be angry at them. And so that's how they determined that the crows were capable of recognizing faces, human faces.
For people who spend a lot of time with animals, I think it's very natural to, in a very simple way, study their behavior. And, you know, a lot of us who have dogs and cats, we may tend to anthropomorphize or give them human characteristics. But in your book, you write about the fact that some of the behavior that we are observing is actual evidence of animal cognition, not just me giving my dog a personality. And one of the things that you write is that maybe it's time to shift the burden of proof. And you use an example of how monkeys react when they are stimulated in the way that we would refer to as tickling. And they make a sound that sounds a lot like laughter. And it's very easy to just assume that, hey, they're having fun with this. They're responding as a human child would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with animals that are close to us, like chimpanzees and bonobos, I feel that if they react very similarly to similar circumstances, we need to assume that the psychology behind it is very similar too. So for example, chimpanzees who have been in a fight, they will after the fight come together and they will kiss and embrace each other. And then they sit down and then they groom each other. And I call that reconciliation. But when I did that, there were objections to it. And people would say, well, you don't know if it's the same as human reconciliation. Why don't you call it post-conflict contact? And so people are always pushing for this sort of neutral terminology. And I feel in the case of animals so close to us as chimps and bonobos, which are 98.5% identical to us in terms of their DNA, so they're very close relatives, you need to assume similar psychological processes, and we should not be so afraid of anthropomorphic terminology. Now, if you go more distant, if you go to, let's say, fish or lizards, or if you go more distant, it becomes more problematic, and we have to be a bit more careful, obviously. And with your average dog and cat, I think most people who have dogs and cats at home, they know pretty well how far to go in their anthropomorphizing. Sometimes they overdo it, and then we scientists have to call them back and say, well, maybe it's not guilt what they have, or maybe it's not this what they have. But most of the time, I don't think it's necessarily a bad habit.
Now, when you were first publishing your research, and even still, often findings will be met with skepticism and even anger by people who feel like the uniqueness, the specialness that makes us human beings is being threatened by these findings. Now, you have a very different viewpoint about it. Explain your view, because through learning about these other species, you're saying we're also learning about ourselves and how we evolved.
Yeah, the thing is that the comparison with us is really not central to the way I think. So the question whether you are smarter than, let's say, an octopus is not a good question, in my opinion. You have your requirements, and of course you can read and write, and I don't think the octopus can read and write. But the octopus lives in a totally different environment and has a very interesting nervous system that is spread over its whole body. So that it has more like an internet system than a centralized nervous system. And so the octopus can do things. The octopus can, for example, change color and mimic the movements of certain fish so that it looks like a fish like that, or like a sea snake and so on. So the octopus has very different skills, which are also cognitive, which require a brain that processes information. And so the comparison between you and the octopus is really not very interesting. It's much more interesting to see what can the octopus do in its environment that is useful to it, or what can the elephant do, and the elephant has a very large brain, what can the elephant do, or what can a chimpanzee do? And so I would like to judge the animals on their own terms and look at their strengths. So what are they good
and
at?
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Frans de Waal. His most recent book is Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about animal intelligence, animal cognition, and the study of animal intelligence. With me is Frans de Waal. He is a world-famous primatologist and biologist. He's a professor at Emory University and the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta, Georgia. His new book is Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And just before the break, we were talking about how you feel we need to judge animals and study animals on their terms, not on our terms. We bring too much baggage to these questions.
Yeah, so we try to throw things at them that we're good at, like language or technology, and then we're very satisfied usually if we are better at it, and we're very dissatisfied. This has happened a few times where we lost. So there was, for example, a chimpanzee in Japan who has a better memory than humans and was tested on its memory. It could memorize a bunch of numbers on the computer screen much more quickly than humans could. And then American scientists were so upset by it that they went into training to see if they could prove that they could do it. And they were not entirely capable of doing it.
And of course, the chimpanzee didn't train to do that. He just could.
Well, the chimp was trained also. It all required training, but he had sort of natural ability to very quickly recognize a pattern much more quickly than humans do. And I always feel that, yes, you can compare these qualities that we are good at, like language and reading and writing and so on, abstraction, but there are many other skills in the world, and why not look at animals for their own specialized skills? Some animals, for example, are cooperative hunters, like the killer whales, or lions or hyenas, and so they have certain skills that we don't have. They're very highly coordinated, and they're very good at that particular thing.
You write a lot about elephants, and I get the impression that you would like to see a lot more animal cognition research done with elephants to help us understand these unique creatures. But again, you talk about how we bring a very human-centric or primate-centric idea of intelligence to the study of elephants. What are some of the things that you see and other biologists have seen in elephants that make you think that there's a whole world to be explored there?
Yeah, it is sort of logical that we don't so much know so much about elephants, because you cannot set up a lab with elephants at the university. That would not go very well. So for elephant studies, we go to Thailand, and there are many elephants that are under human control there that can be tested on certain skills. Or we do it at zoos. And so, for example, to give an example of what happened with the elephant, if you test tool use in, let's say, a chimpanzee, what you do is you place a banana outside of a cage. You give the chimpanzee a stick, and immediately any chimpanzee will pick up the stick and reach through the bars and get the banana that way. Now, if you do the same thing with elephants, as people have done, the elephant does nothing. And they did it in many different ways and many different times, and elephants don't use a stick to retrieve food. And so they had decided that the elephant is not a tool user and doesn't have that capacity. But now it turns out that if you test them very differently, if you hang the banana high and the elephant cannot reach it, and you give them boxes, and you can even remove these boxes and put them at a totally different area of where they are, they will bring in these boxes towards the place where the banana is and stand on top of them and then reach the banana. So they're able to use a tool, which is the box, but they're not willing to shut off their smelling organ, which is their trunk, to pick up a stick. And so the explanation of the scientist who did this study was that the elephant smells food, doesn't want to grab food without smelling it, so it doesn't want to shut off its smelling organ, which is also the trunk, and so is willing to use tools to do this, but not its trunk for this. And so we humans, of course, assume it should be using, as if that's a rule, it should be using its trunk, but the elephant doesn't agree with that necessarily. And so it's always... The question is always, how did you test your animals? And if people say they cannot do this or they cannot do that, you always have to ask, did you test them in the right way?
You are a proponent of using dogs, domestic dogs, in more animal cognition research. Why do you feel that would be a good path?
Well, the interesting thing about the dog is that they are very in tune with us. They're safe to work with. So, for example, with an elephant, that's not a guarantee. With a chimpanzee also, chimpanzees can be very dangerous. So to work with dogs, you're sort of safe. And the dogs, they are eager to please us, they listen to us. And so they have all sorts of advantages. The only disadvantage is, of course, that we have domesticated the dog, and it's not necessarily a natural species, as you would call it. And that's the reason why people have been reluctant to work on dog behavior and dog intelligence. But the dog has so many advantages over so many species, and also you don't need to pay for them. It's the owners who pay the maintenance of the dog, and you bring them in once a day or once a week to test them.
So, and you feel like even though they have been domesticated, and many would say that they are not as intelligent as their wild predecessors or wild relatives, the wolves, but you feel like there is enough there to plumb the depths of the canine brain?
Yeah, so I think for some basic problems, like, for example, I'm interested in empathy. Are you in tune with the feelings of others? And there's now increasingly studies on rodents and elephants and apes on empathy. There's a very interesting capacity to share the feelings with others and also to understand their situation. And the dog is a wonderful animal in that regard. We all love dogs for that reason, is because they are in tune with our emotions and we are in tune with their emotions. That's the reason most people have dogs at home and not snakes or lizards or something, is because mammals have that capacity. And so if you're interested in that kind of basic capacities, like empathy or sociability or understanding instructions and so on, I think the dog is a great animal for that.
You are calling for, in your book, a moratorium on human uniqueness claims as we move forward. You point out many times in history where the fact that we say, well, humans are the only animal that can do this, has gotten in the way of research and gotten in the way of understanding. So as we move forward, how do you want things to change?
Yeah, I think that has become an obsession with some people, especially in philosophy departments and anthropology and psychology, not so much in biology or neuroscience, but in some of these humanities departments, people have gotten so obsessed by what is special about humans. And for me, it's really not such a great question. And also the track record of that question is very bad. That there's basically no claim that we have seen over the last 50 years that has survived the science that we're doing. And so you can claim that we are the only ones with theory of mind, or the only ones who can make tools, or the only ones who can plan for the future. And all of these things have been shut down by the scientists. And so that's why I'm saying, well, move away from this line of thinking, put a moratorium on these claims because they're pretty useless, and start focusing on human intelligence as part of animal intelligence. Human intelligence is not fundamentally different. We don't have parts in the brain that the monkey doesn't have. We don't have neurotransmitters that the monkey doesn't have. So why would we even assume that we are fundamentally different, and start focusing on the similarities and the continuity, and how our special brain, because our brain is special in terms of its size, how our brain has evolved.
Frans de Waal, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure and an honor. Frans de Waal is a leading primatologist in the world. He's also a biologist. He was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. He is a professor at Emory University and the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta, Georgia. His most recent book is Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. And of course, we've been talking about animal intelligence this hour, how we study our fellow creatures and what we can learn about them, what we can learn about human beings as well. And my next guest is Jill Preetz. She's a professor of liberal arts and sciences specializing in biological anthropology at Iowa State University. And for the last 15 years, she's been studying the lives of savanna chimpanzees in Senegal, dividing her time between field work and her work in Ames. And she is with me now. Hello, Jill.
Hi, Charity. Always great to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. And one of the things that I was talking with Frans de Waal about, and he writes about in his most recent book, is a scientific overreaction to the idea of anthropomorphism, or ascribing human characteristics to other animals. He calls that anthropodenial, and I know other people who've used that term over the years as well. And it made me wonder, in your work with observing the behavior of chimpanzees, which of course are some of our closest relatives on Earth, how do you find the line for yourself between comparing the chimpanzees to humans, or trying to understand them as you understand the world, and looking at it just through the lens of them as other creatures?
Well, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that is one of the reasons that I just, I'm a big fan of Frans's work. And I think that he's exactly right, in that we really run the risk of doing a disservice to not only the animals we study, but ourselves as scientists by, swinging too far in that direction of anthropodenial, and ignoring the fact that we share traits with especially closely related species like chimpanzees. So definitely there are, fortunately there are checks and balances. And so it's, I think if you spend time with any primatologist, as well as other, scientists, or even, just people, the way you chat about your pets, for example, is probably not that different from the way that we chat about the chimpanzees when we come back from a day in the field. And so it's like a soap opera, and we'll come back and say what happened. Well, David was a little bit unruly with Mike, but Mike really kind of had it coming because he was getting all the other young males, to take his side in the fight. And so the way we talk about it when we're at camp is, we use language like we use when we talk about people. And then though when you write about something for scientific peer review, of course, it's very different. And so the language itself, and the interpretation of it. And I mean, I think it is a fine line. It's something that we always have to be cognizant of. But for me, it's just as important to be cognizant of the fact that as scientists, we're humans and we cannot be completely objective. That to me is an impossibility with a human. And so to acknowledge that we have certain biases, you know, whether those be our academic biases or cultural biases, I think is just as important.
Now, of course, your work is probably best known for your observations of tool use or spear hunting among the Fungoli chimpanzees. They use rudimentary spears made out of sticks to kill bush babies, little tiny primates, and eat them. And when you first observed that, I'm sure seeing what was happening, it was apparent to you immediately. But again, now as a scientist, you can't go based on one observation or even necessarily on your gut reactions to something. So when you talk about those checks and balances, can you use that as an example of, okay, you see a behavior, how do you move forward to prove it scientifically that what you've seen is what you think you saw?
Right. No, and that's a great example because in part sample size, it's always good to have bigger samples. So when the behavior was sort of first coming to light at Fungoli, my project manager, Paco Bertolani, was talking with me about the chimpanzees. And he, you know, was talking about the fact that they use these stick tools that they modify to jab into hollows. And we were trying to figure out why, what they were after. And you see, you know, sort of similar behaviors at other sites. And there was one behavior of a chimp rousing a squirrel at another site. But it was really new. And so we were, you know, trying to think of different, you know, hypotheses about what they were doing. And then he did see a young female or subadult female, Tumbo, actually then capture a bush baby. And that's when I was teaching at Iowa State. And when I went out that summer, I think I saw over a dozen more cases. And we published that initial paper and we had 22 cases, but there was a lot of skepticism and, you know, people doubting what we were seeing. Some of the criticism I think was kind of, you know, funny. So they were, you know, thought they were playing, which it was pretty obvious to us that they were not playing. And then, you know, that they would, I don't know if it was that they would accidentally get a bush baby at certain times, but, basically sample size. And now we recently published again, last year, a paper that has now we've got over, I think in that paper we reported over 300 cases and now we're over 350. So in part it's just waiting it out in terms of the kind of studies that I do, which is long-term observational. And so a bigger sample size was key to that. But I think that's a good example because at first, and the other thing was that we recognized this was something different. And so with something different, then you kind of have to go above and beyond to demonstrate, you know, that this is what is happening.
Well, and I think in any scientific field, skepticism is a wonderful tool, but it is interesting. And again, in Franz de Waal's book, he had so many examples of observations and studies that show animal culture or cognition or behavior that meet with this backlash of skepticism that seems to be out of proportion to what has been discovered. I mean, have you found that in your observations of the chimpanzees that there are a lot of people who really want to explain this away for some reason?
Right. I definitely have. And I guess what surprises me more is when it comes from primatologists, especially other people that study chimpanzees, because I feel like we all should have an idea of, you know, how clever they are. And it's very hard to describe to people, I think, exactly how clever chimpanzees are, because we usually, most people have, you know, knowledge of a pet or something like that, and they're quite clever, but they, you know, don't measure up to chimpanzees. But that was, I guess that was most surprising to me, was that, you know, people that studied chimpanzees were, if anything, sometimes more skeptical. I was, though, surprised at how, you know, I got, you know, a few emails from people and not very many, fortunately, but a few saying that, you know, I was kind of making things up, and they basically assumed some sort of underlying agenda. And but it kind of boiled down to, again, that somehow we were chipping away at our own superiority. And that is something that is difficult to overcome. So trying to explain, you know, as an anthropologist, how evolution works, and not, you know, everything will eventually, you know, humans aren't the sort of the pinnacle of evolutionary success. And we equate, I think, our success with intelligence. And so, yeah, it's a complicated issue. And I was surprised to see, you know, a lot of people embraced it and thought it was great. But I was surprised at some of the skepticism that we received.
I'm talking with Jill Preetz. She is a professor of liberal arts and sciences, specializing in biological anthropology at Iowa State University. And for the last 15 years, she's been studying the lives of savanna chimpanzees in Senegal. We will talk more in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about animal intelligence this hour. And with me now is primatologist Jill Preetz. She is a professor of liberal arts and sciences at Iowa State University in anthropology. And we've been talking about some of the behaviors that she has observed over the years. She's been studying savanna chimpanzees in Senegal for the last 15 years. And you shared with us a beautiful video from a number of years ago that shows, and we'll put this up on our Facebook page as well so people can see it, but it shows a mother chimpanzee trying to demonstrate for her offspring, at least this is how I'm interpreting it, how to use one of these tools that we were talking about, a spear, to hunt. And it's really a beautiful example of teaching behavior and the implications of teaching behavior and passing along this behavior among this whole group of chimpanzees is such a powerful example, because it shows us that this group of chimpanzees that you're studying has its own unique culture. Why is that so important to be able to demonstrate that?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, and it's also a good example because it does illustrate how we define behavior according to our own species. And so while I think it's a great example of teaching, it doesn't quite fit the definition of active teaching that we use to define ourselves. And I've actually, I don't know if Franz remembers, but about 5 years ago, I contacted him about this particular video and we chatted electronically about it. And I still plan on writing it up at some point. And one of the things he told me was basically what he talks about in his new book, and the fact that we use this, what I call in my class, an anthropocentric view, and that's defining everything according to our own species. And so oftentimes the definitions we use, you know, species just can't measure up because it's you know, impossible. And that is exactly what you see with that video, is that the female Nicole is what we call her, and her daughter Tava. Nicole is just hunted with a tool, and then she, you know, uses the tool. She kind of gets Tava's attention, and she inserts it back into the cavity, and then Tava comes over and uses it. But what we would call that would be facilitation and not active teaching like you see in humans. And to me, that's one of the reasons that I think it's interesting on one level to point out that we have a very, I think it's a biased view of animal behavior. But another, I think it is that many people will see, just like I think most who look at that video, that they are very similar to humans. And especially these days, when we have such a drastic decline in the numbers of chimpanzees and other great apes and other animals around the globe, I think that's especially crucial. And we definitely have seen that with chimpanzees in West Africa, where I work.
In this day and age, it's so easy to share videos. And sharing videos of animals doing extraordinary things is something that a lot of us really love to do on Facebook or on Twitter, et cetera. I think about the videos of the honey badger, Stoffel, who escapes from his pen over and over and over again. This has gone viral and gone all over the world. And it strikes me that being able to share these videos is kind of a unique way to get the message across or communicate some of the observations that you're seeing and other people who observe animal behavior in a new way. I mean, way beyond scientific papers, which of course a select few read. Do you like this tool? Do you feel like it's another tool in your arsenal as far as communicating with people about what you've learned?
Oh, I definitely do. And in fact, if I when I give public talks, I have at least four or five videos because I think people would much rather see the chimps behaving than having me, you know, just talk about it. And so I definitely think so. And there's things that I just can't, you know, I can't send the message home, you know, in my words as well as I could by showing that video of Nicol and Teva hunting, that sort of thing. And then, yeah, the idea that it brings to us images that even if you studied honey badgers in the wild for, you know, decades, you're likely not to see that same type of behavior. So that's something, too, is that you get glimpses of behavior and it allows people to make interpretations and that sort of thing. The only thing that I don't really like is sometimes I feel like I'm pressured to have video of things. And it's somewhat difficult because when I take video or film, and I usually don't have a camera out with me, I've got my iPhone with me. It takes away from me being able to record variables sort of in the old fashioned, but still sort of the standard way we do it. And so I'm, in a way, it restricts what you're looking at, because when I take data, I'm looking at, I have a wider lens because I can look around and the chimps really spread out. And so for me, studying an animal that has a, you know, wide group spread, you know, if something is going on like some, you know, big fight or something, just looking through a camera lens is going to restrict me. But in other cases, it's definitely something I use. I'll pull out my iPhone and get, you know, behaviors that are very focused. So even meat sharing and begging and things like that. But I couldn't get probably a good image of a hunt, you know, unless right. It was a bush baby hunt.
Now, recently, you were involved in publishing a paper about chimpanzees. And these were not your Fungoli chimps, but chimpanzees placing stones in the hollows of trees and bashing trees with rocks in what's a possible ritualistic behavior. The scientist who made this observation couldn't come up with another reason necessarily, although communication was a possibility. In talking about that kind of behavior, that invites a lot of speculation. You know, many people immediately thought, well, perhaps we are looking at the evolution of religious beliefs in primates. How do you feel about that kind of speculation based on what scientists are seeing in the field?
Well, I wouldn't quite take it that far, but that's sort of, you know, that's often what happens is that, you know, you've got your basic behavior, what have you described, and then it's kind of taken a step further. But it kind of comes back to this issue of language and, you know, you could anthropomorphism, but the word ritual was fine. So we all reviewed the paper before it was published. And it really depends on how you define ritual. So we have, you know, operational definitions that we provide when we talk about behaviors or concepts or what have you. But then, you know, people, when you talk about something that is really that resonates with people or that they're familiar with, then they're going to have their own definition. And so, you know, other people's definition of ritual probably involves religion. And so that's where things get a little sticky. You know, it brings a lot of attention to the paper, but I think that taking it that far is you know, something probably very few of the scientists on that paper would do. But one thing we always do with non-human animals is try to come up with some, you know, basic function for their behavior. And if you look at chimps across study sites, sometimes they just have different ways of doing things. But I don't know if humans don't kind of like that and they want to explain it differently, but they just do things in a different way. And some people have called that culture, which can be, you know, not everyone likes using that word with non-humans, or traditions. And so it's just the fact that chimps at certain sites do things differently. And I think that is an example of communication, but it's a very distinct example. And to me, it's fascinating because the longer we study chimps, the more interesting things we find. And also the fact that this was done with unhabituated chimps. So they use camera traps to see this. So that was, yeah, I thought that was really interesting paper, but didn't quite take it as far as, you know, origins of religion.
But as far as ritualistic behaviors, I mean, you've seen something among your chimpanzees that could fall under that category, and that's their reaction to fire. Can you tell me what you've seen?
Right. So their reaction to fire, I compared to their reaction to thunderstorms and to really hard rainstorms. that are accompanied by thunder and lightning. And it's, I only saw this reaction to fire once, and it was by the alpha male, but chimpanzees, especially males, display a lot. And so these are very exaggerated movements, and they're running around, and chimps' hair stands up. They have, piloerection, it's called. And so they're very, fluffy looking, and they run around and they throw things at Fongoli because there are a lot of rocks there, and they may drag branches, and they usually chase other individuals who flee. And it's interesting because during rain displays, they also include me in these chases a lot more often than I'm chased normally. So it's interesting. But they're also very, I guess, stylized, and they're, at least at Fongoli, they're almost in slow motion, unlike a display by one male against another, or when he arrives back at a group after being gone for a while. It's very exaggerated, you might say. And that display that I saw the male give in the face of this really intense bushfire was along these same lines. And, just me speculating about it, and I think it's similar to what other people have thought. It's, they don't have control over this situation. That is a scary situation, I would think. It appears to be somewhat scary, or at least it, I would say it makes them nervous. They're quite anxious. So during rainstorms, it's difficult to follow chimps. They exhibit, behaviors that indicate they're anxious, and not just, normal rainstorms, but when there's a lot of thunder and lightning. And with that really big bushfire, it seemed to be a similar sort of response. And so I call it very ritualized behavior.
And people have called that kind of a display with thunderstorms, they've called them rain dances. And people could call what you're talking about maybe a fire dance.
Right. Yeah, I think fire dance is a good word. If we go with rain dance in the face of thunderstorms, then I think, fire dance would be what you would call that.
You're headed back to Fongoli this summer again?
Yes, I'm headed out in just a couple of weeks, in fact.
All right. What are you focusing on right now with your group of chimpanzees?
Well, June and July are the major months in which chimps hunt bush babies with tools. And so that's one of the reasons that I'm always there at that time of year. I've never been in Iowa during the summer. I guess I never will be because I hate to miss the chimps hunting. And so we always focus on that. But we're adding sort of a new twist. And so I have one of my graduate students, Nicole, who is defending her master's this week, in fact. She's going to come out and help me kick off a study of the bush babies themselves. Because, one of the questions that I've had, and I've kind of shifted how I think about the answer to this question over the years, is that why is this such a seasonal behavior? It's very seasonal. And I thought it had to do with the chimps and their grouping behavior. And to some extent, that may be the case. But I think it also probably has to do with the bush baby behavior. And they're not easy to study because they're nocturnal. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to equip her with some of these little spy cameras. And so it's actually called a borescope. And so they have like a long sort of wire, and she's going to use this to spy on bush babies and to look at not only, their presence or their absence, but aspects of the architecture of their the cavities they stay in. And she's going to train one of my field assistants to do this. And so he's going to continue this on a long-term basis. So then we can look at, bush baby nesting behavior across seasons and, why chimps are successful in some cases and why they're not. And there's a lot of cases where we're almost sure there's a bush baby in a cavity, but the chimps can't get it out. But I'm unable to climb up and see. And so Nicole will be much better at climbing than me, I'm sure. And then, she's going to have this little spy camera. So it's interesting. It's definitely preliminary. And so we're going to just kind of sort out some methods to use. But I think it'll be an interesting and really fun project.
Well, and you talked about how you and the other people who study the chimpanzees, you kind of follow the soap opera of daily life. And there has been a lot of drama with your troop lately, with your alpha male of the troop, who you call David. What happened?
Well, yes, David, and I have to say David is one of my favorites, so I'll come clean on that. He was recently really basically beat up by most of the other males in the group, especially this cohort of young males who are subordinate to him, but, pretty high in the hierarchy. So Mike, Luther, Bo, Jumpkin, and they really did. Yeah, he got beat up pretty badly. I was worried about him, and he seems to have recovered fully. He's still on the top of his game.
So he still maintains his role as alpha male?
Yes. Yeah. The first couple of days that he was injured, they wouldn't let him come around. In fact, they chased him away from a water hole, which is significant. And so he ended up staying by himself around the water source. And also they didn't let him approach an estrus female. So that's a pretty big deal. But since then, that was several weeks ago, he seems to have recovered fully. And yeah, he's back on top. And he is quite an aggressive male, I'll have to say. So yeah, we've had only a few alpha males, and they each slightly differ in terms of their temperament, but David's kind of I wouldn't call him a tyrant, but he's a little heavy handed as an alpha.
Now, I know that every time an infant is born in your troop, it's very exciting for you. Are you expecting any? Do you know?
I am. And well, I kept thinking that Natasha was going to have a baby while I was gone. So it'd be nice if she waited until I got there, but, you know, we can tell to some degree based on their estrus swelling cycles that, you know, whether or not they're pregnant. And so I thought for sure that she was going to have a baby over the past few months. But, yeah, it'd be great if she waited until I got there. And also her kid, Pistache, is he must be about 5 now. And usually they have infants, you know, around every 4 years. So, yeah, I hope she has one when I get there.
And something else you've been working really hard on. We've talked about Toto on the program before, but Toto was an orphan chimp that was rescued in 2012 after his mother died. And so he was raised by human beings, and you're trying to get him into a sanctuary. What is the challenge with that?
Well, the big challenge really is it comes down to really, I hate to say bureaucracy, but on one level, you know, paperwork and forms and permissions and that sort of thing, because chimpanzees are CITES I protected endangered species. And so you can't just kind of ship them across borders. And he hopefully will be going to a sanctuary in a different country in West Africa. But, you know, so you have to get all the proper paperwork in hand. The sanctuaries themselves, there's a really nice network of sanctuaries in Africa, but they are at capacity. And so to go to a sanctuary, we actually have to build a new enclosure for Toto and his little peer group. So he'd be with chimps of his age. But there's just not room or facilities there. There's space, but not the facilities. So that's something that we've been doing, is raising money for that. And, you know, we're just hoping to hear any day that Toto can go. And literally my project manager and research assistants are ready to jump in the truck with Toto. So, you know, I may not see Toto again for a while, but, you know, he's doing great. He's the king of his little kingdom. So he has no worries whatsoever.
All right. Well, Jill Preetz, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, well, thanks so much for asking me, Charity. You know, I love chatting with you about chimps.
Jill Preetz is a professor of anthropology at Iowa State University. She spent the last 15 years studying the behavior of savanna chimpanzees in Senegal. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.